Gulliver's Travels, Part 3, Chapter 7. The author leaves Legado, arrives at Maldonada. No ship ready, he takes a short voyage to Glubdubdrib, his reception by the governor. The continent of which this kingdom is a part extends itself, as I have reason to believe, eastward to that unknown tract of America westward of California and north of the Pacific Ocean, which is not above 150 miles from Legado, where there is a good port and much commerce with the great island of Lugnag, situated in the northwest about 29 degrees north latitude, 140 degrees longitude. This island of Lugnag stands southeastward of Japan about 100 leagues distance. There's a strict alliance between the Japanese emperor and the king of Lugnag, which affords frequent opportunities of sailing from one island to the other. I determined, therefore, to direct my course this way in order to my return to Europe. I hired 2 mules with a guide to show me the way and carry my small baggage. I took leave of my noble protector, who had shown me so much favor and made me a generous present at my departure. My journey was without accident or adventure worth relating. When I arrived at the port of Maldonada, for so it is called, there was no ship in the harbor bound for Lugnag, nor likely to be in some time. The town was about as large as Portsmouth. I soon fell into some acquaintance, was very hospitably received. A gentleman of distinction said to me that since the ships bound for Lugnag could not be ready in less than a month, it might be no disagreeable amusement for me to take a trip to the little island of Glubdubdrib, about 5 leagues off the southwest. He offered himself and a friend to accompany me, and that I should be provided with a small convenient bark for the voyage. Glubdubdrib, as nearly as I can interpret the word, signifies the island of sorcerers or magicians. It is about 1/3 as large as the island of Wight and extremely fruitful. It is governed by the head of a certain tribe, who are all magicians. This tribe marries only among each other, and the eldest in succession is a prince or governor. He has a noble palace and a park of about 3,000 acres, surrounded by a wall of hewn stone 20 feet high. In this park are several small enclosures for cattle, corn, and gardening. The governor and his family are all served and attended by domestics of a kind somewhat unusual. By his skill in necromancy, he has a power of calling whom he pleases from the dead and commanding their service for 24 hours, but no longer. Nor can he call the same persons up again in less than 3 months, except upon very extraordinary occasions. When we arrived at the island, which was about 11 in the morning, one of the gentlemen who accompanied me went to the governor and desired admittance for a stranger who came on purpose to have the honor of attending on His Highness. This was immediately granted, and we all three entered the gate of the palace between 2 rows of guards, armed and dressed after a very antic manner, and with something in their countenances that made my flesh creep with a horror I cannot express. We passed through several apartments between servants of the same sort, ranked on each side as before, till we came to the chamber of presence, where after 3 profound obeisances and a few general questions we were permitted to sit on 3 stools near the lowest step of His Highness's throne. He understood the language of Balnibarbi. Although it was different from that of this island, he desired me to give him some account of my travels, and to let me see that I should be treated without ceremony, he dismissed all his attendants with a turn of his finger, at which, to my great astonishment, they vanished in like an instant, like visions in a dream when we wake all of a sudden. I could not recover myself in some time till the governor assured me that I should receive no hurt, and observing my 2 companions to be under no concern, who had often been entertained in the same manner, I began to take courage and related to His Highness a short history of my several adventures. Yet not without some hesitation, and frequently looking behind me to the place where I had seen those domestic spectres, I had the honour to dine with the governor, where a new set of ghosts served up the meat and waited at table. I now observed myself to be less terrified than I had been in the morning. I stayed till sunset, but humbly desired His Highness to excuse me for not accepting his invitation of lodging in the palace. My 2 friends and I lay in a private house in the town adjoining, which is the capital of this little island, and the next morning we returned to pay our duty to the governor, as he was pleased to command us. After this manner we continued in the island for 10 days, most part of every day with the governor, and at night in our lodging. I soon grew so familiarized to the sight of spirits that after the 3rd or 4th time they gave me no emotion at all. Or if I had any apprehensions left, my curiosity prevailed over them, for His Highness the governor ordered me to call up whatever persons I would choose to name, and in whatever numbers among the dead from the beginning of the world to present time, and command them to answer my questions, should I think fit to ask, with this condition that my questions must be confined within the compass of the times they lived in, and one thing I might depend on, that they would certainly tell me the truth, for lying was a talent of no use in the lower world. I made my humble acknowledgments to His Highness for so great a favor. We were in a chamber from whence there was a fair prospect into the park, and because my first inclination was to be entertained with scenes and pomp of magnificence, I desired to see Alexander the Great at the head of his army just after the battle of Arbella, which upon a motion of the governor's finger immediately appeared in a large field under the window where we stood. Alexander was called up into the room, and it was with great difficulty that I understood his Greek, and I had but little of my own. He assured me upon his honour that he was not poisoned, but died of a bad fever by excessive drinking. Next I saw Hannibal passing the Alps, who told me he had not a drop of vinegar in his camp. I saw Caesar and Pompey at the head of their troops, just ready to engage. I saw the former in his last great triumph. I desire that the Senate of Rome might appear before me in one large chamber, and an assembly of somewhat a later age in counterview, another. The first seemed to be an assembly of heroes and demigods, the other a knot of peddlers, pickpocket highwaymen, and bullies. The governor, at my request, gave the sign for Caesar and Brutus to advance towards us. I was struck with a profound veneration at the sight of Brutus, and could easily discover the most consummate virtue, the greatest intrepidity and firmness of mind, the truest love of his country, and general benevolence for mankind in every lineament of his countenance. I observed with much pleasure that these two persons were in good intelligence with each other, and Caesar freely confessed to me that the greatest actions of his own life were not equal by many degrees to the glory of taking it away. I had the honour to have much conversation with Brutus, and was told that his ancestor, Junius, Socrates, Epaminondas, Cato the Younger, Sir Thomas More, and herself were perpetually together, a sextumvirate to which all the ages of the world cannot add a seventh. It would be tedious to trouble the reader with relating what vast numbers of illustrious persons were called off to gratify that insatiable desire I had to see the world in every period of antiquity placed before me. I chiefly fed mine eyes with beholding the destroyers of tyrants and usurpers, and restorers of liberty to oppressed and injured nations. But it is impossible to express the satisfaction I received in my own mind, after such a manner as to make it a suitable entertainment to the reader. End of chapter 7. Read by David Russell. For Lit2Go. Available on the web at fcit.usf.edu.